Welcome back again to badquaker.com. This is in our interview series. I believe this is interview number 8, if I recall. And with me on the phone is Kurt from the Free State Project. Well, I'm not actually from the Free State Project. Well, why don't you explain, Kurt?
Well, I moved to New Hampshire from the Detroit area of Michigan about a little more than 2.5 years ago. And I moved because of the Free State Project. But in general, we don't normally call ourselves project members or participants or something like that. Once you get to New Hampshire, the Free State Project itself has kind of fulfilled what its intent was.
Mm-hmm. Perfectly. How many, do you know roughly how many people have moved to New Hampshire and how many have committed to so far?
I don't know the commitment numbers. I know that the movers are somewhere in the 1,000 range right now.
Mm-hmm. Now, somebody who might be familiar with the Free State Project might be more familiar with some of the, how do I put this politely, some of the more radical activities that they've been associated with, like the...
Sure.
The 420 protests and some of the stuff going on in Keene with intentionally getting arrested for this or that. But there are, correct me if I'm wrong, more calm aspects of the Free State Project as well. So then a different way of saying this might be to say that, yes, there are radical anarchist, anarcho-capitalists involved. Yes, there are moderate libertarians involved. And yes, there are every level and between those two that are just the nature of human beings. Now, in your case, you also have somewhat, well, you teach classes. Tell me about that.
Teach classes on how to be a responsible engage in the thought process, learn something they didn't learn before. But at the same time, we want them all to be fun and enjoyable. There's no reason learning can't be fun.
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason we can't learn about something that we enjoy doing. And, another thing that we want to do is give parents who are homeschooling their children, but maybe have kids who are in the middle school to high school age range, just a little bit older, where maybe they've had a good homeschooling experience, but they don't want a steady diet of mom and dad 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Right.
And they need a little something to mix that up. We also, one of the things I really enjoy about school is that we take suggestions. If somebody wants a particular class, we'll find an instructor for it, and if we can get 5 or 6 students who want to take it, then we'll offer the class.
Mm-hmm.
So we really encourage people to give us a lot of feedback on the website and let us know what they'd like to see.
That's pretty spiffy.
Yeah.
You actually make money at that?
Yes, we do.
That's
yes,
good.
We do.
That's good.
We're not living too high on the hog yet, but we are in the black. So anytime you can have an educational venture that's in the black, I think you're doing all right.
Absolutely.
Certainly the government schools don't fall into that category.
I just started to make that comment. Now, and there is quite a scope of activities that go on pretty much around the calendar. During the warm part of the year, there's the Pork Fest, Porcupine Festival, and coming in February is another activity that you posted about on Facebook. Why don't you tell us about that?
Sure. Well, Liberty Forum happens every year. It went on a one-year hiatus last year just because of some organizational difficulties, but it happens every year, and it is a gathering in the southern part of New Hampshire. You can get all the details on the website for the Free State Project, which is freestateproject.org or .org. But Liberty Forum has a bunch of speakers come in, folks doing demonstrations, folks who have things to say about, a way that you might achieve personal liberty, be it through your own personal economic activity or through there are going to be people talking about their versions of libertarian philosophy. There are some outdoor activities as well. There's usually a shoot, which is indoors because it's February. I think they're planning a big sledding thing this year, too, just to kind of have fun and enjoy some of the winter weather here in New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a good time. It is just it's a fantastically good time. Lots of good people getting together and sharing ideas and thoughts. Jack Spearco of the Survival Podcast is going to be speaking there this year, I'm happy to say.
Mm-hmm.
I know you're a fan of some of his work. And
yeah.
I'm pleased that he's coming so that we can hear some of his thoughts up close and personal.
If you get the opportunity, get him to barbecue some chicken for you. He's got a really good barbecue chicken recipe.
I will tell him that.
Now, with Porcupine Fest, that's the warm weather event that takes place, and you got some sort of unexpected, almost endorsement from some of the folks on public radio over that one.
Yeah, that was interesting. Porcupine Freedom Festival started out as sort of a long weekend event, and it's turned into a week-long event now. It's held up in the northern part of New Hampshire in the middle of the summer. You can find information about that at the Free State Project website as well. And it is just a fantastic book party and learning environment, and just there's something for everybody.
think this year, I really wanted to go this last, in 2011, I really wanted to go, but it just circumstances wouldn't allow it. But if I recall, you guys had a pretty good lineup of speakers that included guys like Stefan Molyneux and Robert Murphy, and just a real, and if I recall, Bob Murphy did his zombie routine. It's basically like the Sturgis of Liberty.
Yes, it is.
It, in a sense, you know, that's what Sturgis was for bikers in the beginning. It was just a chance to be free and to not have, you know, they didn't really recognize it as the state so much, but they just, you know, to have authority over their head constantly, Sturgis was a place where bikers could go and just be free. And of course, now that's not the case. That's not what Sturgis is now, but that's still what the Porcupine Fest is. I thought it was really interesting, the unique, if any of the listeners are not familiar with the little cards with slivers of gold or silver that have different weights that most people don't think of when they think of, you know, hard money standards and so forth, but the little cards passing around, you have a tendency to say it's like if they're passing money, but in actuality, they really are passing money when they're doing that, rather than the little funny little green pieces of paper with dead presidents on them.
Well, I think one thing that it helps us remember is that money is just all it really is a chip that represents a certain amount of your labor or a certain amount of your brain power or a certain amount of the value that you're able to bring to other people. Mm-hmm. You know, and I might give you one of those funny-looking little pieces of paper from the Federal Reserve and say, gosh, Ben, thanks for doing this podcast. Or you might give me one and say, wow, you know, thanks for teaching that class at the informal university.
Mm-hmm.
But really all it is, it's just a way to give somebody a chip or an IOU that says, you brought me some value today, and so I'm going to give you some of the value that I generated in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And it really doesn't matter what it is. I like gold and silver. I think it's wonderful to have a precious metal that holds its value better than those little green pieces of paper do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the Shire Silver Project that you're speaking of, where you have the little threads of gold and silver, so that they're, you know, like a credit card size, they fit easily in a wallet. They're not as heavy and jangly as silver ounces or gold ounces. I think that's a fantastic idea.
Mm-hmm.
I also think, you know, it's important to remember that all this is value that somebody has generated, and then they're passing it to somebody else in exchange for value that that person has generated. One of the things that I think people lose sight of, and they see this money floating around, whether it's gold or silver or reserve notes or bank checks or, you know, little ones and zeros that are attached to, you know, the national debt or something like that, is that if nobody's generating any value, you really don't need to give them any of that stuff.
Yeah.
And I think it's a question that we ought to ask a lot of our government officials, all the way down to clerks at, say, the Department of Motor Vehicles and that sort of thing, is, but remind me why I'm giving you this.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that you seem to have a right to demand some of my, some of the fruits of my labor,
mm-hmm,
for this particular thing? I'm not sure I want this service. I'm not sure that I want to be served and protected to within an inch of my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And, you know, and that's not to say anything bad about any one particular branch or manifestation of government, but I think it's a worthwhile question whether somebody is libertarian-leaning or anarchist-leaning, or whether or not they're liberal or conservative or anything else, is, you know, what's the value here, and what is it exactly that I'm paying for?
Yeah. I think we get accustomed to thinking of all the layers of government as just being there and necessary, and we don't give it any further thought. And in the meantime, it just keeps ballooning larger and larger, consuming more and more and more of what the value of the real production is, you know, because they don't actually produce anything of value as far as like a product or anything. And like you're saying, if we don't question the service they're offering, well, then what's going to keep them in check?
Right, exactly. And, you know, I think it's also interesting to think about things like that. Every now and again, somebody will say, well, you know, we have to have government, or we won't have any roads, or we won't have any mail service. You know,
mm-hmm,
government doesn't actually build the roads. They usually hire people to build the roads.
Right.
Those road builders and those road building companies, or, you know, even if it's somebody who works for the highway department, those people would still exist, and those skills would still exist,
mm-hmm,
without government. And I guarantee you, if somebody wanted a road built, they could go out and hire a company or hire an individual to do that very thing for them.
Yeah.
They wouldn't have all the administrative overhead that a government institution has. Now, one of the things that drives me crazy is when people say, well, we have to have this program or this thing because it's compassionate to do so. There's nothing compassionate about compelling someone to pay for a program that you think is worthwhile. What's compassionate is to do something like bake an extra loaf of bread and take it over to your neighbor who just lost their job.
Right.
That's compassionate. You know, what's helpful and compassionate is when you see somebody who needs a hand, you offer them a hand, and you offer it to the best of your ability and, you know, within your skill set or whatever the case may be, but compelling people to help is not a measure of compassion. You know? And by the same token, it makes me a little bit crazy when I hear people say, well, you know, we have to do this, or, you know, or we'll be weak nationally. We won't have a strong defense.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? People defend what they value, and
exactly,
they defend their life and their liberty and their property.
Yeah.
If it matters to them, and you're not going to have to compel people to go do that. You're not going to have to compel people to stand up for themselves. It's a little bit of a ridiculous argument to say, you know, we've got to spend these trillions and billions of dollars to have systems that are unequaled anywhere else in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have the capability to do things that nobody needs to be doing.
Yeah, exactly. It's a funny thing, too, because you're inferring there about the military situation. People will make the argument that, well, we can't we can't just leave national security into the hands of a voluntary situation because, you know, who would take out the trash, so to speak? But the problem with that thought is that we've had an all-voluntary military for, 30-some years? So they are voluntary. Now, you say, well, somebody would have to pay for it. Well, if people are willing to volunteer because they believe that it's important to have a military, then people would volunteer to pay for such activity. And, you know that's the case because there have been very large groups of voluntary people who made up security forces of one kind or another, either strictly for financial gain or, as a duty to their country and their duty to who they perceive that they were protecting. That's happened over and over throughout history, and it would happen today. Just because an individual can't imagine it right now doesn't mean that it couldn't be, you know. That's an interesting thought, and unfortunately, it kind of brings me to something that I've been punching at recently, so I'll probably bore some of the listeners by bringing this back up again, but I don't think that if you measure the amount of money that the government actually brings in through the Internal Revenue Service, it's a very small percentage of the money that the government actually puts into their budget and uses. So I make the argument that you could eliminate the Internal Revenue Service today and the size of government wouldn't change tomorrow because the only real purpose of the Internal Revenue Service is to keep our heads bowed and keep us not looking at what's going on.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm in this tax bracket, you're in that tax bracket, and that's not fair because I only make this amount of money and you make that amount of money.
Right.
All these other people who aren't paying taxes, when I pay taxes, I'm paying for their this thing or that thing or the other thing. It keeps us divided as a people, and it keeps us thinking about class and stratification.
Yeah.
And realistically, a big part of our issues don't come from the guy down the street from me who makes a little bit less money than I do, or the lady up the block from me who makes a little bit more money than I do. Most of our problems come from government instituting plans and programs, trying to slap band-aids on things, mm-hmm. and trying to control people's lives.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can look at the war on drugs as just a really good example of that. You know, we're going to outlaw these substances to protect people from themselves.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not saying that we all want
Mm-hmm.
And I find it completely illogical that anyone could actually argue that we're protecting anybody from anything by making a substance illegal.
Exactly.
It doesn't make any sense. You're not protecting people by creating a violent gang situation. You're not protecting people by having criminal penalties attached to someone perhaps needing to seek help for addiction. It doesn't make any sense. If there's not a victim, there can't be a crime. If I choose to put something in my body and it damages me, as long as I'm not damaging the rest of society in the process, then there's not a victim there. I might be my own victim, but that's my choice.
Yeah. And
just as easily with, you know, too many corn chips as we can with, you know, with other types of drugs. You know, we can do it with soda if we want to.
Yep. It's a funny thing, too, because, you know, we had that experiment with prohibition with alcohol that lasted, oh my, what was that, from like the 1918 or something like that, 1917, 1918, up to like 1932 or whatever it was. And what we saw...
I'm not going to get those dates exactly right, frankly, so I'm not going to try to correct you on that. I don't remember the exact date. At the right time range, I don't remember the date.
Yeah. But what we saw very clearly was we saw the prohibition itself funded a huge wave of crime and the explosion of crime in all the cities, and the basically the institutionalizing of that crime, making a real business out of it, and not just the crime of dealing bootleg alcohol. That funded real crime where people were actually harmed. And that's what's happening, of course, with the war on drugs now, is that it literally funds the worst people in society to do the things that they want to do that they wouldn't otherwise have the money to do. The war on drugs literally hands them the cash to do those things.
That's right. It does. And, you know, it has all kinds of other consequences. I was going to say unintended consequences, but I don't know that that's the right way to put it anymore. You know, when Prohibition started, America was a place where people drank beer, wine, cider primarily.
Mm-hmm.
Fairly low alcohol content substances, many of which had some food value as well.
Right.
But when you make something illegal, it becomes important to concentrate it into the smallest possible volume that you can, so that you're getting the most bang for your volume, because that way you can smuggle it more effectively.
Right.
And that's when hard liquor really saw its ascendance here in the United States. Now, it happened, you know, rum was a big deal, and whiskey was a big deal at different times because of refrigeration and transportation. But
right.
As far as consumption in the 20th century, it was prohibition that drove us to the hard stuff, so to speak. And the same thing has happened with the war on drugs. The potency of marijuana has gone up because you want to, you know, people are breeding those plants so that they can get the most THC packed into the smallest possible area. People down in South America will pick coca leaves off a plant and chew them like they're chewing, you know, a little skull or a red man or something like that, and they receive, you know, some of the effects of cocaine, but refining cocaine and turning it into the dangerous drug that it is, and then further refining it into something like crack, that all happens because people are trying to get it smuggled into a country, and they want, you know, the biggest bang for the least possible volume. And we see the same thing with other narcotics. Same thing with methamphetamine, same thing with heroin. It's crazy what we do to ourselves in the name of the war on drugs. We destroy people's lives. We create law enforcement institutions where people are no longer peace officers. They are really law enforcers, and they are out to get people on a charge of some kind. Not out to keep the peace, not out to solve a crime, not out to help the victim.
Yeah, and
we have a war on drugs that funds the growth of a militarized law enforcement culture here in the United States, and a war on drugs that funds violent gang activity and violent cartels both here and in other countries.
Yeah.
I don't want to just get caught up in talking about the war on drugs, but it's a perfect example of how government tries to find a solution to something by controlling people's lives, and they just make everything so much worse.
Yeah. I had Robert Higgs on, who kind of coined the phrase the ratchet effect, and that is exactly what has taken place with the war on drugs. The government has first created a problem, and then they provided a so-called solution to that problem, which was, you know, more government, and that created made the problem worse, and so they offered another solution, which was more government. And this, oddly enough, that made the situation worse, and so they offered another solution, which was more government. And oddly enough, that made the situation worse. You know, and I could just keep saying that over and over and over. When in the 1990s, and you mentioned how they ratcheted up the cocaine and literally created a market for stronger versions, which turned into crack cocaine. And then there was a big, you know, crackdown on crack cocaine and a huge militarization that took place with the police at that time. That was in the 80s. And then that forced a market in methamphetamine that didn't exist prior to that time. And then
when we talk about a substance that really does harm to people.
Yeah.
Do from a business or a commerce perspective, just doing it. And some people would say that's Mm-hmm. It's just that they refuse to ask permission for licenses and to comply with all the regulations that get slipped upon a small business these days.
Yeah, and just to toss it out, you know, the what you were talking about there is directly in line with the local crackdowns on the scourge of America, the Kool-Aids or the lemonade stand, as individual little cities all across the United States start harassing kids for having lemonade stands. It's impossible to know the long-term effect of this, of stifling that level of entrepreneurship to children. To sit back and try to think through what that will cause two generations down the road, it's impossible to be able to predict that. But I can predict that it's not a good thing. I mean, that's pretty obvious. But above and beyond that, what you're talking about there, you know, I'm guilty of constantly using the word black market instead of correctly saying what it is, and I call for a black market in everything. I mean, I think that the way to defeat the evil that I see as the state is specifically by ignoring it and going around it and living a life and not harming anybody, but engaging in commerce on every level that is possible without asking permission.
Absolutely. It's one of the reasons that the Informal University is not an accredited school. We're never going to be an accredited school. We're offering some knowledge, and we're offering bite-sized pieces, but, you know, we're not running around and saying, oh, we need this certification, we need that certification, we need the other thing, and this. So we're just going to teach valuable things to valuable people, so that they can go out and create more value in the world. And we don't need anybody's permission to do that.
I want to contrast that back to what we're talking about a minute ago, too, or what you were mentioning, the compassion, and forcing someone to donate to something is not compassion. There's also a bad aspect to that as well, that I was reading this not long ago, and I should have had it in front of me if I was going to refer to it, but I can't remember exactly what part of government, but I know it's in the general canopy that I consider welfare, but I can't remember the exact aspect of what government giveaway that it is. But the numbers being quoted in the article I was reading said that for every $1, basically, that makes it out onto the street to help people that are poor and having a hard time in life and, you know, need help with whatever, for every $1 that gets to them, $5 is wasted by government in the bureaucracy levels, so they have to steal $6 to get $1 onto the street. If a person's really compassionate, you know, give your own dollar, it's a lot cheaper. What if you went to a McDonald's and the tax on buying a hamburger from McDonald's was five times the cost of the hamburger? I mean, we wouldn't tolerate that on any other level, but we have slowly accepted it through the government, and we don't even notice that it's there.
Right. And, you know, that hamburger that you buy from McDonald's or, you know, wherever else is taxed in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of places have sales tax. A lot of places have a meal tax or food tax. Those employees that made that burger, they're being taxed. They're being taxed for Social Security. They're being taxed for income, often at both a state and a federal level, and in some places at a local level as well. You know, all those taxes go into the cost of that hamburger. So do taxes on fuel to transport those hamburger patties in a big old 18-wheeler. There are going to be taxes on the fuel that's used to generate the heat to cook that burger. There are tremendous agricultural subsidies that we're all taxed for, that we all wind up paying for.
Yeah.
Which is basically the government's way of picking winners and losers among the farmers in the food industry. And, you know, one thing that absolutely drives me crazy is when government policy corn is too low. We need to pop up the price of corn. it is just insanity to me that we pay so much to get people to produce things in a certain way and try to control the economics of the situation from a government perspective, when if you just give it a little bit of time, the market will take care of itself. It's not going to be any bumps in the road.
Mm-hmm.
Of course there are going to be some bumps in the road. But that's just life.
Yeah.
It just happens that, you know, there may be a season where we've got way more wheat than we want and way less corn than we want.
Mm-hmm.
Guess what? By next planting time, that situation is going to reverse itself.
Yeah.
And, you know, the way we try to control all these things, you know, regulations on biofuels are absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah.
And what amazes me is some of the large corporations who are engaged in the energy trade now want to say, oh, I'm being green, oh, I'm doing this, oh, I'm doing that. You know, we're promoting biofuels research. But they put so many hurdles in front of a small business person who wants to do a little research and a little experimentation in that area that they kill a lot of the innovation.
Yeah.
So the situation we're in right now is that we really have a combination of big government and big corporation, and in a lot of ways, big union as well.
Mm-hmm.
And as we mentioned earlier in the podcast, I believe I just moved from the Detroit area a little less than 3 years ago. And if you want to look at what the combination of big government, big corporate, and big union can do to a town, then take a look at Detroit at the turn of the century. Take
yeah.
a look at Detroit in the middle of the last century.
Mm-hmm.
And take a look at Detroit now.
Yeah.
It's absolutely amazing between big corporate situations, between big union demands, and between big government policies, both on their effects on the economics and the way that they handle things like the war on drugs. I mean, it's amazing to me that a city that was once that beautiful
mm-hmm.
Can now be the backdrop for zombie apocalypse films without having to have a set redesign.
Yeah, yeah.
They can just use Detroit when they want to have a post-apocalyptic city scene. It baffles me. It baffles me. And I think that anyone who's a big fan of either big corporate, big union, or big government, just go spend a weekend in Detroit. And if you make it back, then we can have a conversation about it.
That's a really, really good point. Walter Block does a thing in a presentation. I'm pretty sure it's Walter Block. Does a thing in a presentation where he has a picture, a select picture of several cities, some of which are, you know, basically bombed out, like World War II type bombed out cities in Germany, that type of thing. And others are modern pictures of, like, certain areas of Detroit, certain areas of New York, certain areas of Los Angeles. And then he challenges people in his presentation to show him which ones were bombed and which ones the government fixed. And it's hard to tell. You know, there are parts of Detroit that absolutely look like the Blitzkrieg moved through it. Yeah.
Because they finally got everything torn down. You know?
Yeah, and actually I was reading about this. The city of Detroit is kind of pulling in and abandoning large sections of town and focusing their efforts on other areas while just basically acting like the other, like some areas don't exist anymore. And that's probably the best thing that could happen to those neighborhoods.
Any number of things, but in general what they're doing is they're pieces of land that aren't being used by anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So, places that maybe somebody does have a legal claim to them, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But that the city has taken for property taxes and whatnot, and they're trying to, you know, create a situation where they can live and thrive and survive. I would have some concerns about the amount of lead in the soil, personally, under those circumstances, just because, you know, it wasn't called the Motor City for nothing.
Right.
But nature does find a way.
Well, that's one of the really nice things. Let's take it back to New Hampshire. That's really one of the nice things about New Hampshire is that, we're going to have a dog barking. Nikki, be good. I brought her into the office specifically so she wouldn't bark. She barked all the way through the Bob Higgs interview the other day. Anyway, where was I?
Dogs in my house too. We might hear them at some point.
New Hampshire, although it has cities, it's not like it's just all, you know, abandoned forests or something, but New Hampshire has never really suffered the kind of state abuse that places like Detroit and, you know, even where I'm at here, you go into downtown Cincinnati and Dayton, and you just see devastation. Dayton, there are areas of Dayton where you just look at the abandoned factories and shake your head and realize these were vital companies, names of companies that everybody recognizes. There's a massive GM plant in Dayton that's just sitting there with, you know, trees growing up in the middle of the parking lot. And, you know, the town is dying right before your eyes. But that's not happening in New Hampshire because New Hampshire never had that kind of concentrated state activity. And I use state like the, you know, not the state of New Hampshire, but state as in that evil entity that's doing everything that's bad that we can think of.
Right. I mean, I don't want to paint a picture that New Hampshire is a perfect and idyllic land, even though it is. But there are certain areas, you know, Manchester had a terrible time for a little while. I believe it was mostly in the early 80s because the textile business was largely going overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And you have all these old mill buildings and textile factories on either side of the river that runs right through the middle of Manchester. And for a while, those were shuttered. But now, you know, you'll find schools, you'll find computer companies, you'll find, just any type of business you can imagine in those buildings, and they command, you know, quite a nice rent as well because they're these, you know, lovely old historic buildings with hardwood floors and brick structure and all that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The city of Berwyn up north in New Hampshire is having a hard time because their primary industry was pulp and paper, and, you know, that's an industry that's taken a beating.
Yeah.
However, I know of many people who are moving to that area now because of the low housing prices. You know, and as people move in and start businesses up and do that sort of thing, or as people move in with their new internet commuter jobs where they don't really have to go to an office every single day.
Yeah.
And then they bring those communities back. New Hampshire really is a beautiful state, and I do love living here. I grew up in the Carolinas and then lived in Michigan for a long time, and it kind of reminds me of the best of both worlds. I get all the seasons in New Hampshire, but I get a lot of the same beauty and sort of terrain that you get in the upstate part of both North and South Carolina.
Mm. Let's mention
it's a wonderful place, and it's not frozen here all the time. Sometimes I talk to people and they're like, it's cold up there. You know what? It's not as cold as it is in the Midwest, really.
Yeah.
Not most of the time, anyway.
I was about to bring that up. That is a sort of an assumption because New Hampshire is pretty far north. There's this idea that it's you know, a frozen Canadian tundra type. But even most of the inhabitable parts of Canada are not really the way a lot of people picture it. But New Hampshire specifically, because of their location close to the Atlantic Ocean, Of course, you have the four seasons you mentioned, but you don't have the kind of harsh Arctic air that just comes down on you and squats on top of you like we do in the Midwest. Where I'm at in Ohio, every February, you have 2 to 4 weeks of just brutal cold air that hurts. Whereas the closer you get to the Atlantic, the more that breaks up. Of course, you still have the big storms that come through. Like, hey, I meant to ask, how's the storm hitting you right now?
We did have some snow last night. I think we had about 8 inches here. It's completely gone off the roads now because it was 45 degrees and sunny today. And because one thing about living in a state like New Hampshire is, you know how to plow the roads. It gets done really quickly. A lot of that's private contractor work, by the way. Although the highway department does maintain the highways. There are a few people without power because their leaves were still on the trees when the snow came down, and a heavy wet snow on leaves is going to take some branches down, and that means taking down some power lines. But, it's not a disaster or anything like that. It's just a snowstorm.
Well, did you lose your power?
Oh, no.
I meant to ask you that when we very first started the interview. I meant to start with that, since that's kind of the current news all over, but it slipped my mind. Anyway, we've about hit our hour, and I want to thank you for coming on the show with me. And I want to encourage everybody to check out the websites that we're talking about here. I'll put links on the page on badquicker.com where this interview is. And be sure and check those out. Give some serious thought about coming out in February to the, the name of it just escaped me.
Liberty Forum.
Liberty Forum, yeah. And give some serious thought to going out to the Porcupine Festival and all the other activities that take place in the Free State that are at the, they're listed on the website of the Free State Project. You can find them there with links and everything. And I'll put a link to the Free State Project. Well, I already have a link to the Free State Project on badquicker.com, but we'll add them on this page as well. And again, links to Kirk's school and to the Shire Silver's website, which they even go to the point of having demonstrations as to how you can make your own cards with the silver and gold strands in them. So be sure and check that out. And once again, Kirk, thanks for coming on the show. You want to mention any other websites while we're at it?
Thanks a lot, Kurt. Thanks, man.